fact, I want to thank those of you who really helped out when I was speaking at Real Life Church this Sunday before last, or this past Sunday. It was a remarkable event. They wound up having an attendance that's about 30% higher than normal. And, you know, we really needed everybody there to deal with this. One of the best responses we ever had. So I want to thank you for that. And also want to thank Ross Hoagland that made it possible for me to exit this class. I don't know where Ross is. He's standing in line eating his own treats. All right. But Ross, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate all the guys here. I mean, we got Rich Dean here and, you know, Mark. And all of you make it possible for me to exit this class once in a while and speak somewhere else. And I'm going to be counting on you again next Sunday, because next Sunday I'll be speaking at Pomona First Baptist. And again, I understand some of you are volunteering to help with that event. And we actually need more, so if you can help, let us know. They only have 3 services there instead of 5, so it's a little easier in terms of logistics, but they're predicting a pack-out, so we're going to need all the help we can get for that. And the pastor there is super excited, mainly because he brought his daughter's boyfriend over, who is a skeptic, just to talk to us, and he got all of his questions answered. I mean, really turned around, and there's nothing like having an impact on the family. So anyway, appreciate your prayers for that event, because just like with Real Life, we are walking into a church where there is significant opposition to our message. But I think what's making it helpful is that the pastoral team at Real Life was definitely in our camp. And the same thing's true of First Baptist Pomona. By the way, I'm going back to First Baptist Pomona. I spoke there 33 years ago, so it's a whole new ministerial team. And they just discovered us and want us to come, so it's exciting. A lot of new scientific discoveries, but last time I brought some scientific discoveries, we never got to the lesson. This time we're going to hit the lesson. Time remains, we'll do some scientific discoveries, otherwise we'll pick them up at some other time. But what we're doing is going through the creation Psalms. Those of you who haven't been with us in a while, we're actually going through every major creation text in the Bible. We started with Genesis 1, did Genesis 2. We're working our way through the Bible. We're a little more than halfway through. I don't know how many years it's taken us to get to this point, but we are doing this in some depth. And we're looking at the last two of the creation Psalms. The book of Psalms is loaded with Psalms that deal with the subject of creation. And this is the last two. It's Psalm 147 and 148. And we're looking at Psalm 147. And those of you who have been here for a while realize the psalm begins by talking about the stars and how vital the stars are for our human existence. And the second theme it picks up is the rainfall. Now, this kind of reflects on Genesis 1. Because what does Genesis 1 start with? It starts with the universe, the stars and the galaxies. And then it talks about the light that comes upon the face of the earth, so the photosynthesis can begin. But the next thing that you see in Genesis 2 is the water cycle. Well, you see a similar pattern here in 147. Psalm 147 isn't as detailed as Genesis 1 or Psalm 104 or the Job creation text that you see in chapters 37 through 39. It's a brief psalm, and it's kind of hitting the highlights. But the second highlight it hits is the water cycle. And you see this in, starting in verse 8, speaking about God. He covers the sky with clouds. So yeah, if you want a water cycle, you're going to need clouds. I think we all understand that. He covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain and makes grass grow in the hills. He provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they call. So it kind of ends by making the point that God not only provides a water cycle for the plants, but also for the herbivores and the carnivores. So he's making a contrast between the cattle and the ravens. Ravens are carnivores, and the cattle are herbivores. And you actually need a different kind of water cycle for these different species of life. And this is where we're kind of segueing to what you see in Job 37 and 38. An entire chapter and a half that expands upon this single verse that we see here in Psalm 147 and what you see back in Genesis chapter 1. Now, if we can have some of the lights down, we'll take you quickly through this and jump into where we are right now. So, Genesis 1, creation day 2, it talks about God setting up a water cycle. It doesn't actually say that. What does it say? Waters in the sky above and waters in the seas below. And you might say, well, why do we need that? Because after all, at that time, all you got is a water world. And it's true. You don't need a water cycle if planet Earth is only going to have oceans. And that's where life began, in the oceans. And so this is, again, another signature of God's involvement because, hey, if you've got no continents, you really don't need a water cycle. But God is looking forward to where there will be continents, where He's going to create life in the continents, and He knows that life is going to need a particular kind of water cycle. But all you have in Genesis 1 is a single sentence, that God is going to set up this situation where He got water in the atmosphere above and water in the oceans below. Water vapor in the sky and liquid water in the oceans below. And of course, the water cycle is the evaporation of that liquid water forming the clouds. And when you've got continents, it's also going to be necessary to move the clouds. I mean, you could imagine a water cycle where you've got a planet, where you've got oceans and continents, but the clouds only form over the waters. And that's actually the normative situation. You would anticipate that you would typically only get clouds forming over the oceans. But God designed our planet in such a way that the clouds move from the oceans over the continental land masses and drop their water on the continental land masses. Now, what you see in Job 37 and 38 is an amplification. Matter of fact, we did an exercise in this class, remember? We had you spend about 20 minutes going through Job 37 and half of Job 38. And actually, the assignment was to pick up everything the text is saying about this water cycle. And what we found is that what you see in Job 37 is that it describes three different kinds of liquid precipitation. That God sets up this water cycle so that you get rain, mist, and dew falling on the continental land masses. Now, what was really good about the exercise we did, several of you noticed that the text actually breaks the rain down into subcategories. Now, here's the whole point of all this. You're going to need every single subcategory in order to have life thriving on the continental land masses, because the continents are big. God's not just looking at small continents. He's wanting to create big continents. And it's much more of a challenge to move the moisture from the ocean 2,000 miles inland than to move the moisture from the ocean to, say, 50 miles inland. And so this is the kind of a water cycle God wants to set up. So we've got rain, mist, and dew. And we spent some time discussing what those different forms are. And then it breaks it down into four different kinds of rain. Okay, here in Southern California, we really only think of the first kind, showers. That's typically the kind of rain we get. But hey, I grew up in coastal British Columbia where we seldom got showers. Instead, we got this, downpours. Okay, well, where you get maybe an inch of rain in just a couple of hours. And actually, there's another term you see in the book of Job that talks about something more intense than a downpour, and that's torrents of rain. Now, torrents of rain is something similar to what happened in Colorado these past few days, where they get their typical annual rainfall in one day. So in one day, they wind up getting 15, 20, 25 inches of rain. That's torrents of rain. And yeah, I've experienced that growing up in British Columbia, that sometimes you will get these torrents where the rivers will go from maybe having a foot or two of water in it to where they got 30 or 40 feet of water flowing so fast that it takes houses with it that happen to be along the shoreline. And then the fourth category is a flood of water, where the rain falls in such a way that you wind up getting these enormous floods that remain for days, weeks, and sometimes even months. So, three basic kinds of liquid precipitation, but with the rain, there's four different kinds of rain. Now, what we're doing here in the class is we're hitting the frozen precipitation first, then the liquid precipitation. So we're actually going to come back to all these different kinds of liquid precipitation and, based on what the Bible says and what we get from the book of nature, determine why we need all of these. Because sometimes we look at things like downpours, torrents of rains, and floods of water as acts of God. We call them natural evils. They're not natural evils at all. They're actually critical for ensuring that life thrives on the continent of the land masses. We do need downpours, we need torrents, we need floods. All of those are crucial. We'll be explaining why that's the case. But, now that we're so heavily urbanized with all of this advanced infrastructure, we typically prefer that it just be showers all the time. But the truth is, we do need all four. We'll get back to that. But what we've been focusing on first has been the different kinds of frozen precipitation. So yeah, I got a slide here of snow falling. You don't see snow falling here in Southern California, but snow does fall in many parts of the world. And then you have frost, and you've got hail. Now, the point we're making here is that you're going to need frozen precipitation everywhere. And that's the advantage of God setting up a water cycle where you get snow, frost, and hail. Because that's frozen precipitation that literally can take place on any part of the planet, even in the equatorial zones. Now, one thing we discussed when we talked about snow is that notice that we happen to be living at a time in the history of the Earth where the mountains typically get taller as you move towards the equator. I mean, you especially notice that in North America. I mean, if you go up to, say, the Canadian Rockies, you notice that those mountains are between, say, 6,000 and 12,000 feet elevation. The highest one is just under 13,000 feet elevation. And then you move into, say, Montana and Washington, and they get a little bit higher. You move down to Colorado, you got 14,000 foot high mountains. Here in California, again, we got 14,000 foot high mountains. Now, what if we didn't have 14,000 foot high mountains? Then we wouldn't have much snow accumulation. Because the mountains here in Southern California, notice that too, we have higher mountains in Southern California than Northern California. Southern California doesn't get as much precipitation as Northern California. And so it's crucial that the precipitation we get be predominantly snowfall, where that snow can now provide valuable water for our agricultural lands. But hey, move down into Mexico. As you move into Mexico, the mountains aren't 14,000 feet high, they're 17,000 feet high. Okay, and then as you continue to move towards the equator, hey, North America moves towards the equator, there's not a whole lot of land, right? And notice the land gets very narrow. You're not going to need high mountains, say in a place like Panama or Costa Rica. Why? Because none of that area of Central America is far from the ocean, and therefore it's much more likely they're going to get adequate waterfall. Whereas if you look at, say, the United States and Canada, they're 3,000-4,000 miles across. So it's much more challenging to get the precipitation you need, and that's where you're going to need the mountains to accumulate that snow. Because one of the big advantages of frozen precipitation, it slowly melts. Now, we talked about the property of water. Water is an unusual substance in that it takes an enormous amount of heat to take a cubic centimeter of frozen water and turn it into a cubic centimeter of liquid water. Remember, we talked about the fact that if you take a cubic centimeter of liquid water and raise its temperature by 1 degree, how much heat do you need?
540 calories.
Yeah, okay. But how much heat do you need to raise a cubic centimeter of water from 30 degrees frozen water from 32 degrees Fahrenheit to liquid water? That's exactly the same temperature. You need 80 times as much heat. This is why it's good to have ice as a refrigerant, right? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, I grew up in a poor neighborhood. My wife says, hey, we had refrigerators, even back in the 30s here in California. We didn't get refrigerators in our neighborhood until, the mid-60s. So how do we survive before that? The Iceman came. He would bring a cubic feet of ice and put it in our ice box, and it would take more than a week for that cubic feet of ice to melt. And that's, you know, because it takes so much heat to melt ice from 32 degrees Fahrenheit, just to bring it to 32 degrees Fahrenheit liquid water, it kept all of our food cool enough. And that's just one of the properties of water, but it has a huge advantage. That means when snow falls on our mountains, it's going to take a lot of heat to turn that snow into liquid water. And so what that means is you can have a very heavy snowpack, for example, on the Sierras here in Southern California. And 9 months later, when there's been no precipitation at all, you know, that can happen here in California. We can go 6 months without any precipitation. But it takes so much heat to melt that snow that 6 months later, you still got melting snow. And so that's what provides the water in all of our rivers that we use to irrigate our farmlands. And it's because of that snow that falls every winter that we're able to sustain such an aggressive agricultural industry. You know, California ranks first in the U.S. for agricultural production, but it wouldn't if it wasn't for the snow that falls on the high Sierras. And it wouldn't if it wasn't for the property of water that it takes so much heat to turn frozen water into liquid water at the same temperature. Now, for snow to fall, the temperature has to be 32 degrees Fahrenheit or colder. So that means you either got to be pretty far up from the equator or you got to be on a high mountain. And again, hey, if you look at the flip side, look at the Andes, notice that the mountains get taller as you move north. And even Ecuador has a mountain that's so tall that snow falls upon it in winter, and that melting snow actually helps feed the Amazon. Yes. Pardon me? Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you go back to North America, the mountains get shorter and shorter in terms of elevation as you move north until you get to the high north. Then you got these really high mountains. So yeah, the highest mountain in Canada is just under 20,000 feet. But it's at, you know, latitude, I think, 61 degrees north. Likewise in Alaska, you've got Mount McKinley, you've got several other high mountains. You know, the St. Elias Range, they're running from 15,000 to 20,000 feet. It's a relatively small area. We're going to get to that, actually, because one of the things you see in the book of Job, it talks about ice and then sheets of ice that cover the liquid waters. And this is something that you actually do see in the far north. And actually, I find it quite impressive that book as old as Job, evidently that people knew something about these frozen sheets of water that cover the seas. So anyway, we're coming to that. And it's another part of the design. But the whole point here, did I lose? Oh boy. Let me get this back in. Yeah. This doesn't quite make it into my, there we go. It should come back. We got one. We got both. They're back. All right. Okay. Now, the whole point about snow, you're not going to get snow unless the temperature is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we spent some time talking about frost, if you remember. The fact that there's like, what, 8 or 9 different kinds of frost. And the thing about frost is it can form when the ground temperature is, say, 35, 36, even 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can get frozen precipitation in a place where the ground temperature is above 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Why? Because the temperature on the surface of leaves or the surface of fruit, for example, or on the bark could be below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the ground temperature is not. Also, you can get wind blowing that will chill the air sufficiently around, say, leaves, where the temperature can drop. So that's one way of getting frozen precipitation in places that are warm. So Florida, for example, gets frost, even when there's no snow falling. Here in California, we can get frost. And the interesting thing, too, is you can often get frost forming at low elevations where it doesn't form at high elevations. Why? Because cold air sinks. And you get cold air sinking, and it's moving at a fairly high velocity, you can wind up getting frost at low in these little concavities of landmass. Now, we haven't talked about hail, but let me also kind of tell you where we're going to be going after that. We're going to be talking about ice. Ice is different. So we've got snow, frost, and hail. And one of the things about hail is, and we're going to be talking about hail a little bit at depth, is that hail can fall anywhere on planet Earth. Even in a place that's extremely hot, you can get hail. Why? Because hail typically forms at high elevations in the atmosphere. So, for example, if you get a thunderhead that's 30,000 feet high, I mean, most of you have been on an airplane, right? And when you're flying on an airplane, the pilot will often tell you what the temperature is outside that little thin piece of aluminum that's protecting you from the outside elements. And we'll say things like, well, you know, right now, outside of that thin piece of aluminum, it's 40 below zero or 60 below zero. I mean, it's really cold. And it's that cold everywhere on planet Earth. So, I mean, if you're flying over the tropics at 30,000 feet or 40,000 feet, guaranteed it's going to be way below freezing. So if you get a thunderhead that goes up 30,000 feet, it takes you into that stratosphere where it's cold enough for ice to form. We'll get to that. That's hail. But the whole point is, we now have a means, thanks to the water cycle that God has designed for planet Earth, where we can get frozen precipitation, literally, over the entire planet. And then we get ice. This reference to ice in Job 37 is referring to permanent frozen water. Okay, so you get snow falling, and snow will melt if it gets warm enough. Now, it might take months for the snow to melt, but it will typically melt. But there are places on planet Earth where the snow falls and not all the snow melts. If the snow hangs around for a few years, that snow will turn to ice. You might say, how do you get ice at high elevations when all you get is snow? That's how what happens. If the snow hangs around for several years, it compacts under the influence of gravity, eventually compacts enough that it forms ice, because snow falling on top of it creates pressure. And the snow on top will create enough pressure to compactify the snow below and make ice. Another term for that that we use in the 21st century, we call it a glacier. So ice that's permanent, that remains upon the land, we call a glacier. And we'll be speaking in a minute, we'll see if we get to it today, why glaciers are critical. And by the way, when we talk about why glaciers are critical, why ice ages are critical. We have global high-technology civilization because we're following after an ice age. What happens in an ice age? I mean, what's happening over the past, millions of years is that we typically get an ice age that lasts 90,000 years and builds up these huge sheets of ice. I mean, the last ice age, for example, covered Canada with several thousand feet of ice. And that ice sheet went all the way down here into Southern California. So, a good chunk of the United States, about a third of the United States, was covered in this huge ice sheet. But when you get a warm interglacial, that enormous ice sheet melts. And what does that do? It feeds the rivers. And so you get these rivers forming from this melting ice sheet, and that gives you a huge amount of water that you can exploit for agricultural purposes. And there's actually references of this into the Bible. The Bible talks about four mighty rivers that met together in the Garden of Eden. Two of them flow today. They flow because they're taking advantage of ice melt from the last ice age. The mountains in Turkey and Russia still have ice left over from the last ice age, and that's what feeds the Tigris and the Euphrates. When that ice disappears, the Tigris and the Euphrates will become dry riverbeds. The Gihon and the Pishon that are mentioned in Genesis 2 already are dry riverbeds. But the time of Adam and Eve, those rivers were mighty flowing rivers. Why? Because they were being fed by the receding glaciers of the last ice age. But those glaciers that existed over the mountains of Arabia today are gone. And because that's an area that doesn't receive a lot of rainfall, those rivers are now permanently dry. Yes.
In Isaiah chapter 8 and Revelation chapter 4, it makes reference to the Euphrates. What's going on there?
Well, there are prophecies in the Bible that the Euphrates will dry up. And a lot of people are thinking maybe what's going to happen to the Euphrates is that it will dry up, just like what happened when Cyrus, the king of the Persians and the Medes, came in and conquered Babylon. A little sidetrack here. Babylon, the time of Nebuchadnezzar and the kings that followed Nebuchadnezzar, was considered an impenetrable fortress. It had walls about 200 feet high and about 100 feet thick. And the city of Babylon had a 20-year supply of grain inside. And the Euphrates River flowed right underneath the city walls. So they had a water supply and they had 20 years of grain. And because of that, that was a time in Daniel when Babylon had two kings. And because of the fact that this city of Babylon was considered impenetrable, the main king of Babylon took most of the army of the Babylonians and went down to conquer the kings of southern Arabia because he wanted to enlarge the kingdom of Babylon, and left a tiny garrison inside Babylon. And he knew the Medes and the Persians were a threat, but he figured, hey, there's no way they're going to be able to break into the city. We got a 20-year supply of grain. We got all the water we need. There's no way they're going to be able to overcome those walls. Matter of fact, military strategists have calculated those walls would have been unassailable until the early part of the 20th century. The artillery that was available to say the Germans in 1870 would not have been adequate take down those walls. You would need World War II style artillery to be able to have any impact. However, what does it tell us in the book of Daniel? The Medes and the Persians took the city of Babylon without a fight. And historically, we know how we did it. They spent months damming up the Euphrates River and diverted the Euphrates River. And so that, here were the Babylonians celebrating the fact that, hey, they're living in this city that cannot possibly be conquered. They were feasting. And as the text says, they actually brought out the gold goblets that they captured from Jerusalem, and were using those gold goblets and bowls to celebrate the fact that they were invincible, unaware of the fact that the Medes and Persians had diverted the Euphrates River. And so how did they conquer the city? They walked under the city walls on the dry riverbed of the Euphrates. Walked in there and took the city without a fight. So the handwriting on the wall. I mean, it's a neat story. If you've never read it, take a look at the book of Daniel and what happened there. But there are people that read the text, because there are texts of saying the Euphrates will dry up in the days before the return of Jesus Christ here to planet Earth, before the second coming. And so they're speculating that what's going to happen is another army is going to invade that area and it will divert the Euphrates River. So, now, another way you could speculate on how that could happen, although I don't see it happening right away, what if all the snow and ice that's on the mountains of Ararat were suddenly to disappear, say, as a result of some global warming phenomenon? That would dry up the river. Without that snow and ice melt, that river will not flow. Same thing's true of the Tigris. Yes?
So about how long will it be until the Euphrates dries up?
Well, if you're counting on the Euphrates drying up as a result of this ice pack on the mountains of Ararat melting and disappearing, that's going to take a while. A minimum of several decades, unless there's some gigantic warming event that happens in that area. I mean, again, I've read Bible speculation on this. They said, well, maybe if there was some kind of huge forest fire that took place that wound up melting the ice, or if there was a volcanic eruption that could melt the ice. But failing that, you're looking at least several decades.
So maybe 100 years.
Yeah, even with an aggressive global warming phenomenon, it's going to take time. I mean, the snows on Kilimanjaro will probably disappear within the next decade.
So within our lifetime, Jesus won't be here for
Well, unless you reinterpret that text as saying maybe the river dries up as a result of being diverted. Kind of like what the Medes and Persians did. I mean, that's another way you could see the fulfillment of that prophecy. So yeah, I'm not helping you any on that one. So. No man knows the hour of the day because it's difficult to understand the precise interpretation of the text there. So anyway, moving on. So we need ice. And then also talks about the frozen surface of the deep. Yes.
Is sleet included with ice, or what is sleet?
Well, sleet is rain that falls as rain, but becomes frozen as it hits the ground. Okay. Yeah. And sleet's not included.
Okay.
It could be. There really is no Hebrew word for sleet, so it might have been included in the rain or the snow. But it is true. You can get rain, and by the way, sleet is when you have rain right at the freezing point of water. And typically what happens when you get a sleet storm, you both get wet and cold at the same time, because some of the rain is liquid, some of the rain is like little frozen drops of ice. And what's dangerous about sleet is that typically it's a little bit colder, say, on the branches of trees than it is on the ground. So I've been in sleet storms, for example, where there's no ice at all on the ground, but the trees are just loaded with huge amounts of ice. And it's quite an interesting phenomenon, because you look on the ground, no ice. But on the trees, the branches have 3 inches of ice wrapped around the branches. And of course that becomes dangerous, because that ice weighs a lot. And what it does, it causes the branches to break, and people get killed as a result of... Well, maybe that's why it's not showing up in Genesis 37. I mean, and you typically sleet is temporary. So, anyway, moving on. Frozen surface of the deep. So what is that referring to? Well, think of the Arctic Ocean. Think of Antarctica, where you literally... And when it talks about the surface of the deep, it's usually referring to salt water. So we're talking about ice that remains on top of the surface of the oceans. And that usually requires a fairly northern latitude for that to happen, although it is possible. I mean, because after all, we're well after the situation of, say, Job 37. I mean, if you go back thousands of years, the Ice Age was much more evident than it is today. I mean, we really are at the very end of the last Ice Age. There's very few glaciers that are still dominant on the face of the earth. But thousands of years ago, the glaciers were much more evident than they are today. And there would have actually been glaciers coming right down to the seas, even at fairly mid-latitudes. So, for example, Norway quite recently had glaciers that came right down to the sea. That's also true of British Columbia. Glaciers came right down to the sea. Few places they still do, but it's rare. But that's what we're talking about here. But where it's obvious today is Antarctica and the Arctic Ocean. Okay, let's just kind of pick up where we left off. Remember we talked about all the different kinds of frost that you get? So this is an example where you can get frost forming on vegetation, but no frost on the ground. And, you know, the frost can get fairly sophisticated, where you've got frost crystals that are literally inches long. Here's an example where you get frost forming on pine needles, and actually looks like pine needles. They call this hoarfrost. Hoarfrost is where you can get frost flakes that are literally several inches long. So there's an example, and here's one that you can compare with the eye. There's a frost crystal. And so when you get frost that's that big, it can take quite a while to melt. You know, and here's an example of a frost flower. This is about 5 or 6 inches long, and we're seeing it well after the sun is up. And so you're looking at 11, 12 a.m., and there's still frost on the ground. Why? Because the frost crystals are so big, it takes a long time for them to melt. And I think, hey, here in Southern California, you've seen this phenomena where you get... Pardon me?
The previous one, why would the background grass not be covered with any ice? Well, this one's got thick ice on it.
Okay, what's happening here is you've got branches of a tree that are coming down towards the ground. And it's the branches that are winding up being much colder than the grass below. So that's why you get this huge... But remember we talked about this frost. The beauty of frost is it can form when the ambient temperature is well above the freezing point. And so it's what this does is it provides moisture. So what we see here, for example, in California, is that you can get frost forming overnight, and then the sun comes up, and where it's still shaded, the frost remains. Where the sun comes, it actually melts it. And here you can see that it actually takes quite a while for the frost to melt, because the sun's been on that for, 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and yet it's still frozen. That kind of testifies that even when you've got tiny crystals, it takes a long time to melt. And this can happen when there's no visible rainfall at all, but this thin layer of frost forms. And what that does, it provides moisture for your lawn even when you get no rain. Okay, so that's valuable for those of us who live in a place that doesn't get much rainfall. Question?
Back up in the people survive, or did they live in those ice places with the ice ages, or did they move south?
Well, there is evidence that early humans actually did move into these, quote, frozen parts. And, you know, it's a bit deceptive because with the close of the last ice age, you're going to have these huge ice sheets and this melting ice, but the temperature will be a nice balmy, say, 55, 65, 70 degrees. Because the ice is so thick, that ice can be there when it's really quite warm and comfortable. And why would people live there? Because there's a steady supply of all the water you need. Because those would be glaciers that were melting. The meltwater would be permanent. I mean, it would slow down in the winter where you only get a trickle, but in the summertime you just get a huge torrent of water that comes out, and that means it's going to be very easy to have crops growing in that area because the temperature's warm, you got lots of water. So naturally, early humans moved there just to take advantage of the meltwater. So here are a couple of other examples of frost. Hoar frost that forms on a fence, surface frost. We talked about all the different kinds of frost: air frost, advection frost, rime frost. If you missed all that, thanks to Richard Dean here, we actually have all of our classes recorded. So if you want to pick that up and hear what we had to say about, about 8 different kinds of frost we looked at, and why we need all these different kinds of frost. And another thing about frost is it can be quite pretty. So this is what frost looks like at sunrise. And hey, get up early when it's frosty and you'll get some nice photos. All right. We haven't talked about hail to any great degree. But as we've already mentioned, the wonderful thing about hail, because, I mean, you're not going to get frost in the Amazon jungle. It's just too warm. You only can get frost when the ambient ground temperature is, say, 40 degrees or colder. But, I mean, that works for places like California and Florida. I mean, you can get temperatures that are that cool. So it's one way of getting a supply of water for the agriculture when rain's not falling. You can get the frost. But as we mentioned, you can get hail falling anywhere. Why? Because hail forms in these thunderheads, and here's a hail-forming thunderhead, where the thunderhead has enough elevation that the top of the thunderhead is going to be well below the freezing point of water. And what's happening in a thunderhead is you get these violent air circulations that will move water vapor from, say, this elevation up to 20,000, 30,000 feet. And so that's what happened. That's why people don't like to fly into thunderheads. When you fly into thunderhead, there's these violent air currents that will take your aircraft way up and then drop it way down. And not pleasant if you're... Okay, I won't go into the details. I've been in one of those, and it's not pleasant. It really does something to your stomach. So
sometimes it does something to your airplane.
That can destroy your airplane. Definitely. I think we also mentioned, we were talking about that, that that was actually taken advantage of in World War II. Why? Because the United States had fighter aircraft that were much more strongly built than the German aircraft and the Japanese aircraft. And so when an American pilot was surrounded by, say, 20 Messerschmitt 109s, they knew that they were toast unless they got into a Thunderhead. They would go into a Thunderhead knowing the Germans wouldn't follow them. and their plane was strong enough that they had a possibility of surviving, at least a higher possibility of surviving than trying to fend off all those Messerschmitts outside. And so that was one of the advantages of American-built aircraft. In fact, my uncles told me about how shocked the English were, because these American pilots would fly into these Thunderheads to escape, whereas their Spitfires, they said, no way are we going in there. Well, the thing was, these American planes were more strongly built than the Spitfires. And so what did the British do? They wound up building more sturdy Spitfires so they could do the same thing. Okay, but I don't recommend it. However, it's great for forming hail, because what happens is you get water vapor at low elevation, and it gets moved up to high elevation where the water vapor freezes. But as we mentioned, a thunderhead, you get these violent circulations. So what happens is this water vapor freezes at the high elevation, then it gets dropped down to low elevation, where what happens? That little tiny ball of ice picks up more water vapor. Then it gets sent back up, and it gets bigger and bigger as it continues to circulate. Now, depending on the thunderhead, you're going to get different sizes of hailstones. Because if it's a 30-week thunderhead, there reaches a point where the hailstone weighs too much to be recirculated on another round trip, and then it falls to the ground. But if you've got a really big thunderhead with really violent air circulations, then the hailstone can build up to a fair size and then drop to the ground. But these thunderheads can literally form anywhere. Well, they have a higher probability, interestingly, of forming where you're far from the ocean. We don't get a lot of hail here in Southern California. Why? We're too close to the ocean. Whereas we go to Kansas, they can get really violent hailstorms. Well, there's an advantage in that, because if you're close to the ocean, you've got a pretty decent probability of water evaporating from the ocean and falling as precipitation, because you're not too far from the ocean. I mean, here in California, for example, we notice you get a little more precipitation in Long Beach than you do, say, in downtown L.A. Now, if you move up to the mountains, you get more precipitation again, because the mountains actually create a barrier. But being close to the ocean helps, but explains why you actually get more hailstones forming, because these thunderheads are going to get bigger or more powerful when you're far from the ocean. But the advantage of that is you get frozen precipitation falling in a place where the likelihood of getting normal precipitation is low. So this is one way Kansas can get an extra dose of precipitation. Okay.
Out of the number of times that aircraft flown into
Thunderheads.
Isn't it still pretty rare for aircraft, I mean, talking about modern aircraft, to get ripped apart from? Isn't that pretty rare?
It's quite rare because, I mean, I fly a lot. And when there's a big thunderhead in the Midwest, and that happens quite frequently, what does a pilot do? He either flies around it or he flies over it. So yeah, I've taken airplane trips where the pilot will take the plane up to 44,000 feet. What's he trying to do? Get over the thunderhead. Because, you know, if you're an airline trying to make money, you don't want to disturb the passengers too much. And having them bounce up and down in their seats means that they might take a different airline next time. But much more frequently what they do is they go around the thunderhead. And so it's really quite rare where a modern aircraft winds up getting stuck in a thunderhead. It does happen, but it's rare, because, you know, we have good weather forecasting now, and we can tell a pilot, you know, 500 miles farther down, you're going to run into thunderheads. They're not there now, but guaranteed they're going to form by the time you get there. And so the pilot says, okay, since I know that, I'll go around it. Whereas, say, 40 years ago, where we didn't have good weather forecasting, it was quite common for aircraft to get caught in one of these thunderheads. But if you're flying aircraft, I wouldn't worry about thunderheads. The pilot will make sure you don't get bumped around too much. Yes.
A lot of small private planes are not that strong.
They're not that strong. Moreover, if you're flying in a small aircraft where you don't have a good radio, you may not get the weather report in sufficient time. Moreover, you can't go up to 44,000 or 35,000 feet in a small aircraft. So you got to go around, and then you start running out of fuel. So yeah, it happens much more frequently to small aircraft. Okay, what does a hailstorm really look like? Here's an example of what they call a hail funnel, where you got a big thunderhead, and what you see here is actually a very intense hailstorm, where the hailstone is literally falling out. I don't know whether how many of you have ever seen this, but if you ever come from the Midwest, you quite frequently have seen this kind of phenomenon where you get a thunderhead and you can literally see the hail coming out. Because if it's rain, it's kind of gray, where you see kind of a funnel coming down. But if it's hail, it'll look white. And so if you're driving in a car and you see that, you might want to drive around the funnel. So, because often the hailstones can be a little bit big. Okay. We do get hail here in Southern California quite infrequently. The biggest hailstorm I remember was many years ago in San Dimas, where we got 5 inches of hail that fell within about an hour. And this happened in late April. So the idea that you can get frozen precipitation in Southern California in late April, quite remarkable. I also remember it took 4 days for all that hail to melt. Okay, so if you're short of water, having all that hail is a good thing because it's going to nice and slowly melt into our grasses and provide them with moisture that is going to help them thrive for a long time. So that's kind of what it looks like. Yes?
Since you're talking about Southern California, you know how in the summer you see those big white clouds and it gets very humid here? And it usually rains in the desert occasionally, especially Arizona. They call them summer monsoons, I believe.
Right.
We rarely get the rain on this side of the mountains. So.
Well, yeah. Those summer monsoons that inundate the high desert and all the way out to Arizona. I mean, Arizona gets almost all of its rainfall from what they call these monsoons. And what they are is that happens in the summer when it's really hot and you get these gigantic thunderheads forming. And yeah, they will get hail even when it's 100 degrees outside.
Where's that moisture coming from? Is it from our coast or is it coming up from the south?
Well, you get these thunderheads where you've got a clash between cold and hot. That's often why you get these dramatic hailstorms in the very hottest part of the year. So, I mean, yeah, it could be 115 in Phoenix. They get these gigantic thunderheads forming and a bunch of hail falls when it's 115 outside. So that's one way to get frozen precipitation when it's incredibly hot. But what it takes for that to form is a violent clash between hot air and cold air. So you're going to need some cold air coming from the north or the ocean, conflicting with hot air. And the reason why it happens so seldom here in the Los Angeles Basin is that we don't have hot enough air. Whereas in the desert, they got hot enough air. In Arizona, they got hot enough air. And so, but on occasion, we will get a decent collision between a cold air mass and a hot air mass where it will actually produce hail even here. However, I do notice in that hailstorm that took place many years ago in San Dimas, it only fell in San Dimas. Why? Because you got the mountains there. And because of the mountains being right there, it created a situation where you could get a clash between hot air and cold air, and it dumped all that hail. But hey, the hailstones weren't any bigger than, say, half a centimeter across, as opposed to what we see here. What we see here in this slide, this is a hailstone that's about 3 inches across, okay? So this will actually destroy your car if you've got 3-inch diameter hailstones falling. And if you don't have a hard hat, it'll kill you. Okay, but the reason why I got this slide here, it shows you the layers, okay? So what you can see here is the evidence that this is a hailstone, a bunch of ice that built up by being recirculated in one of these thunderheads. Every time it went up, another layer of ice formed. And actually, if you cut through a hailstone, you can see up to 100 layers of ice. So by cutting through a hailstone, you can determine how many times it circulated through the thunderhead. Now, this is the biggest hailstone that's ever been recorded to fall in the United States. Okay? As you can see, 8 inches across. Okay, so that's Now, there may have been bigger hailstones, but this is the biggest one they've ever found, and they were actually able to measure. So, yeah, that, if that were to fall, if you had 8-inch diameter hailstones falling in your neighborhood, it will flatten all the homes. It'll destroy all the cars. It'll destroy all the trucks. It'll kill any animal that happens to be outside. So, yeah, I mean, if you got a bomb shelter, you'll be fine. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So, yes.
That actually looks like an agglomeration of a bunch of small ones.
Well, okay, yeah, you're observant here, because there are hailstones that are perfect spheres, where you can actually see a sphere of, you know, you cut through it, you can see all the layers, and all of them are perfect spheres. That happens if you've got simple circulation going on in the thunderhead. We're simply doing this over and over again. But, you know, if you look at thunderheads, they tend to be chaotic. You can see, I mean, if you look at a thunderhead, you can see little bits of water, vapor, clouds everywhere. And so it's possible to get complex circulation where it's going up and doing this kind of a thing, which means, and see, what you're really getting there is hailstone forming in globs at different parts along the thing. And so this is a good example. And that's how you can get the really big hailstones, is where it's more than just simple circulation. So, but you can imagine how long that thing will take to melt. It's going to take weeks for that chunk of ice to melt, even when it's quite warm outside. So yeah, it could be very destructive, but it also could be very helpful. I mean, if you're in a really warm area that hasn't had rain, say, in 6 to 8 months, and you get hailstones falling like that, the farmers are rejoicing, because now they've got a supply of water that's going to sustain their crops and allow them to get food and make an income. Whereas if you've got smaller hailstones, it's going to be a quick melt rather than a very slow melt. So as long as you bring all your cattle inside and you've got an appropriate bomb shelter, you'll be fine. So, but yeah, that can be quite destructive. Okay. But again, the big advantage of hail is it can fall anywhere and therefore can provide needed water. Now, if you look at the Bible mentions hail quite frequently. In fact, I'd encourage you to kind of do a word study on hail. It's not just in Job 37. You find it everywhere. Now, what's interesting is about a balance in the biblical passages on hail. Some of the passages talk about God using hail as a weapon. Okay, so you'll see, particularly in the historical books, times when Israel was facing an enemy they couldn't defeat. And how did God take care of the enemy? He rained hailstones on them. Now, you can imagine, you know, say there's an army of 1 million troops facing your army of 10,000 troops, and they get a hailstorm like that. And that's the wonderful thing about hail, from that kind of a perspective. Remember I mentioned we had this hailstorm in San Dimas? Glendora, which is a couple miles away, didn't get any hail. We had 5 inches of hail. And what you see in the historical books is there are occasions when a small Israelite army was facing a vast army they had no hope of defeating. And what happened, even though they were maybe only a mile apart from one another, the two armies, one army got wiped out by the hail, whereas the Israelite army was able to scoop up all the ice and bring it back to, you know, kind of keep their fields well watered, and none of the Israelites got killed. But yeah, if you're standing out in the field with your spears and swords and you get hailstones like this, you're not going to survive. It doesn't matter what kind of armor you got. You're not going to make it. Yes.
And you said, this is where my skepticism comes in, but when Israel is facing an army that would defeat them, I know God can do anything, I guess, but how exactly does God create this hail to fall on those people? I mean, this is supposed to be a natural phenomenon. How does God do it? He doesn't wiggle his nose like Bewitched and say, boom, there's a... How does he do it?
Well, the Bible does declare that God miraculously intervenes to save the Israelites from certain defeat. So when the Israelite army sees this happening, they give God the credit. God, you did this. Because they realize that the statistical probability of this happening in such a way that one army gets completely wiped out, the other army suffers no casualties at all, and winds up being able to loot the dead army of all their valuable equipment, and also be able to harvest all the hailstones and bring them back for their fields. You know, that's something that doesn't statistically happen by chance. So
how would God legitimately do that? Well, how does he?
He's in control of the forces of nature. I mean, we see that particularly in the Job text. You read the book of Job, and you know, Job is debating his friends, but one point that they all agree on: God is powerful enough to control the forces of nature. He designed the forces of nature, but he can control those forces to do his bidding. In fact, there are verses in the book of Job which actually says that God saves up the storehouses of hail for the day of battle.
No, would you say that God, the state of Israel now has been around since 48, would you say that God has intervened since the state has been born? And if he has, I don't hear Israel, does Israel give credit to God?
Well, it's interesting you say that. Read Ezekiel chapters 32 through about 39. Because what those chapters are talking about is how God will intervene on behalf of the second reborn state of Israel and perform miracles for them, just like he did for David and the ancient judges and Solomon. He says, I will do it again. Only here's the difference. Whereas back then, my people gave me the credit for saving them. This new nation of Israel, they will say, we did it on our own. They will not give God the credit. That's actually prophesied in the book of Ezekiel.
But doesn't God generally destroy the nation when they don't give him the credit? Because he's a jealous God and he wants the credit.
Right? That's actually also addressed in the book of Ezekiel. I mean, read that today. I think it'll be very encouraging.
I read the 1 year, but I got 2 weeks more to go and I'm finished my 1 year.
All right. Well, go back to Ezekiel, because what it actually says is, okay, when I do these miracles on behalf of the reborn state of Israel, they will not give me the credit. They'll take the credit for themselves. But he says the Gentiles will give me the credit. And I'm going to use this reborn state of Israel as a way to reach the Gentiles.
So this state now is the reborn state.
It's now the reborn state. In fact, if you look in the book of Ezekiel in some detail, you'll notice that a lot of the prophecies made by the prophet Ezekiel have literally been fulfilled in your lifetime and my lifetime.
Son of a gun.
Yeah. Well, if you were around here about 30 years ago, no, less than that, I gave this set of lectures back in... well, gee, I did, 1980. That is 30 years ago. Guess I'm older than I thought. But yeah, back in 1980, I gave a series of evening talks here at this church, and it was titled Israel, a Modern Day Miracle. And what we did is we documented how God had intervened in dramatic, miraculous ways to save the new nation of Israel and five wars they had with their Arab neighbors. And so I think those messages are still available.
Have they been through the five wars?
Well, I mean, there was the War of Independence in 48.
Yeah.
And so what I did in that series is document how God saved the nation Israel in the 1948 war, the 1956 war, the 1967 war, the 1973 war. And then there was another war they fought with...
94?
Well, it was with Syria. No, it was in the 80s where they had to invade Lebanon to deal with the Syrians that were taking place there. 82, I think it was. Anyway, so I must have given that series back in 83 or something like that. So just 30 years. Anyway... what you see in the book of Ezekiel, that God is going to intervene in incredible, miraculous ways. But that they would not give God the credit.
Well, as a Jew, would it be safe for me to move to Israel? Would I be safe there?
Well, you might be safer there than would you be in certain parts of Los Angeles.
I'd be safer there than parts of London.
Yeah, I think so.
I just mean as my heritage, for my heritage. Well, that's kind of a silly question, but I mean... Is it prophesied that most Jews will reestablish themselves in the in Israel? Or
you'll actually see that in the book of Ezekiel as well. That
Ezekiel gets around, doesn't he?
Well, see, God used the prophet Ezekiel to talk to the exiles that were living in Babylon and was basically giving them a message of hope. Yeah, your nation's been destroyed, and you will return to the land, but you'll be destroyed again, and there will be this vast, you know, mass dispersion of Jews to all the nations of the world.
Destroyed again? Do you talk about the Holocaust? Is that the Holocaust?
No, I'm talking about the time when the Romans came in in 70 A.D., and then they didn't, you know, they did kill a lot of Jews, but basically they dispersed them. So Jews began to be dispersed throughout the whole of the Roman Empire, and from there throughout all the nations of the world. And what you see in the book of Ezekiel, that will happen, but that God would step in and return the Jews to their land, the nation would be reborn, and it gives a lot of detail about how God would intervene to establish his new nation. And yes, there is a particular prophecy that a time will come when virtually all the Jews in the world will be living in the land of Israel.
Did they prophesy about the Holocaust at all?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Chapter 37.
Ezekiel again?
Ezekiel again. Yeah, read Ezekiel. Yeah,
dry
what?
Bones, dry bones.
Yeah, that's the chapter on the dry bones. What do you?
Is that where that song comes from? Bones,
exactly. That's exactly where that song comes from.
That's where it comes from. Did God really resurrect those dry bones? Did he really literally resurrect them?
Okay, here's the context of Ezekiel 37. God gives Ezekiel a vision. He says to Ezekiel, "What do you see?" He says, "I see these enormous valleys filled with dry bones of dead people." And God says, "Those are the bones of your people." And there will come a time when the Gentile nations will see those enormous valleys filled with the dry bones of your people, and they will declare the Jews as a nation are done, they're finished, they'll never rise again. And he says, when the Gentile nations make that declaration, that will be the day the nation will be reborn.
So now, the Holocaust just preceding the state of Israel.
Well, I remember reading that when I wasn't yet a Christian. And I said, I'm going to check this out. So I actually went to the university library and dug out all the microfiches of newspapers written in 45, 46, 47, 48. I wanted to check this out. And indeed, what I saw in those newspapers, London Times, Jerusalem Post, San Francisco Chronicle, I looked at a number of Canadian newspapers, and late 46, 47, newspapers were publishing these photographs of valleys filled with hundreds of thousands of Jewish skeletons. And when those photos were published, this is when you had other news stories saying Zionism is finished. There will be no nation Israel. It's a done deal. Why? Because the Zionist movement was headquartered in Poland. And Poland lost 4 million Jews. And they said, you know, with the loss of those 4 million Jews, and with Poland being the site of the effort to restart, you know, to launch or build or set up this nation of Israel, they said, Zionism is done. It's not going to happen. Well, a few months later, you got the birth of the nation of Israel. So I looked at that and said, hey, this is evidence that the prophet Ezekiel was inspired by the one that knew the future history of humanity. So that's a significant piece of evidence persuading me that the Bible indeed was the error-free word of God. The other thing that impressed me is that what you have there in Jeremiah combined with Ezekiel and Daniel is that when the nation is born, they will not possess any of the high places of worship. Rather, a nation to the east will possess those high places. Interesting prophecy about the nation Jordan, because what you see there is that there would be this nation where they'd come in and would take these ancient high places of worship and make it part of their own land. They would actually promise to make this a separate nation, but they steal it and make it part of their own land. Now you can go back and read those ancient newspapers, 1947, 48. That's what happened. The nation Jordan declared war on the new nation Israel. And they came in and grabbed the territory of all the ancient high places of worship. made the promise that they were going to set up a Palestinian state, but they broke their promise and incorporated all that land into the nation of Jordan. And so, again, you can check that out. And what's really interesting, I remember doing this as a teenager, actually looking at a map. And all the territory that Jordan grabbed to make part of their own nation perfectly encompassed all the ancient high places of worship. You can read the books of Kings and Samuel and actually locate where all those places of worship are. And this nation of Jordan they took and incorporated perfectly encompassed it. And what was really interesting, some of the high places of worship were only a few miles from the border between Israel and Jordan. However, if you read on in the book of Ezekiel, it says a time will come when this new nation, Israel, will conquer and possess the ancient high places of worship. That happened in 1967. Now, I gave my life to Christ before 1967. But as I gave my life to Christ, I said, it won't be long before something happens where Israel gets control of all those ancient high places of worship. And that's what happened in the 67 war. Israel now has control over all the ancient high places of worship. But this book declares that they wouldn't have any of the ancient high places of worship when the nation was first formed. But in 67, they got all the ancient high places of worship.
Are
but,
you prophesized about in the Bible?
No. No, you aren't either. So. However, what is interesting, I do believe that the Bible prophesies a role for the United States of America. Okay? And this actually happened, I believe, in 1948. Because what the Bible declares, I'm trying to remember the exact verse. You can get it on a little sheet that we have that actually records all the passages in the Bible that talk about these miracles. And by the way, you can get that from Reasons to Believe. It's a little sheet called Israel, a Modern Miracle, and all it is a set of scripture verses where you can check all this out for yourself. And it's available for free. So you can get that.
Well, and buy property on the West Bank for your heritage. You will never go back to
what about the former location of the temple in Jerusalem, which is now on the Palestinian side?
Yeah, but it's under Israeli control. I mean, that was one of the ancient high places of worship, was the temple site. And in 67, Israel did not possess a temple site. They do now. They didn't possess Samaria. They do now. There's like 27 ancient high places of worship, the high places of worship, and all of those were under Jordanian control before the 67 war. And then after the war, they're all under Israeli control and still are. So, they would not give credit.
Would we not be in this whole mess of the world?
Oh, yeah, I was going to tell you that. Okay. Where are we mentioned? Well, there is a prophecy. I'm trying to figure out the precise verse. But what it says is that the people dwelling in safety and wealth in the distant coastlands would provide the gold and silver to establish this new nation, Israel. And if you look at the history of the 48 war, David Ben-Gurion went to Golda Meir and gave her $10 and said, go to New York. Here's the plane fare. Here's $10 you can put in your purse and see if you can raise some money. Because if we don't get some money, we're not going to be able to get the weapons to enable us to survive the war that's certain to come upon us. And so Golda Meir arrived in New York with $10 in her purse and came home with $50 million. And those $50 million was the key to the success of Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. And years later, David Ben-Gurion said, it was a woman that won the victory of the 48 War of Independence. That it wasn't for Golda Meir making that one trip to New York. And by the way, she got to New York with $10, visited several Jewish charitable organizations, got some more money. They said, go to Chicago. She went to Chicago and raised some money. And they said, here, you need to go to Los Angeles. So she traveled around to all the large American cities that had Jewish populations and literally came home with the money that turned the tide of the war. Because up until that time, Israel was losing the war. And the goal of the Arab nations was to totally wipe out the nation. But when with that $50 million, that turned the tide.
So the U.S. was the one that really saved them, the U.S.
Well, the gold and silver from people dwelling in safety in the distant coastlands. Yeah, it was basically Jews living in Canada and the U.S. that turned the tide.
And David Ben-Gurion, as we discussed this, he was an atheist.
He was an atheist.
And you're the one that said that he didn't know that he was fulfilling prophecy because they were going to call it Zion. And he said, no, they're going to call it Israel, case closed.
That's true.
That's it.
And that was prophesied by the prophet Isaiah 2,700 years before David Ben-Gurion was born.
Mm-hmm.
Said that would happen. And it did. Anyway, we're a little off topic. And we're also out of time. So, hail. Anyway, I think we're done with the hail. So next time you see hailstones falling, you might want to praise God for the hail. Because of hail, we get frozen precipitation. It melts very slowly. The bigger the hailstones, the slower the melt. As with any form of precipitation, do take precautions. I mean, we talk about the liquid water. Torrents of rain can be really bad for you. But God tells us, when you see the torrents or the signs of the torrents coming, take shelter. And one of the things we can see about the hail, there are signs that hail will form. I mean, if you're starting seeing these big thunderheads, this is when you should take preparation. This is what you see in the book of Job. And by the way, what you see in the Bible, that sometimes God uses hail to bring about a military victory. Other times he uses hail to bless the land that's parched from water. So what we see in the Bible are references to hail that have immediate benefit, also references to hail that God uses for judgment. And to complete your question, is God really controlling this, or is just something happening by chance? I think one of the best stories is the story of Ruth and Barak. And they were facing this invading army. And what did the prophet tell? What Ruth told Barak? Okay, go up to the top of Mount Tabor. And so the Israelite army went up to the top of Mount Tabor.
Deborah.
Thank you for correcting that. Yeah, Deborah told Barak to go up to the top of Mount Tabor with his army. And then there was Sisera with the invading army at the bottom of Mount Tabor. What happened? A torrential rainstorm fell on the army of Sisera, and the army of Israel on top of Mount Tabor was dry. Okay, I've been to the Valley of Jezreel, and what you see in the Valley of Jezreel is a 2,000-foot-high mountain that pops up out of the valley. So you've got this enormous flat valley all around this one lone mountain. Now, if you know anything about meteorology, rain is going to be most predominant and torrential on top of the mountain as opposed to the bottom of the mountain. What we see here in the book of Judges is it happened exactly the opposite. It was dry on top and torrential on the bottom. And this is was the key to the victory of Deborah and Barak. Now, I would argue that has to be a divine intervention miracle because meteorology tells us that won't happen. But it did happen, and it was the key to winning the victory. Likewise with hailstones falling on the army of the enemies, and no hailstones on an army that's, say, just a mile away.
Hail was also used in Egypt, one of the plagues, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Wiped out all their crops. And it wasn't hail like this. It was hail that was a little bit bigger. Okay? Anyway, we're out of time. Next time we're going to talk about the ice and the glaciers, the ice age, why we need an ice age. I mean, I run into a lot of skeptics that say, if there's a God, why do we have a planet with ice ages? We need ice ages to have global high technology civilization. We're the beneficiaries of melting ice from the last ice age. And yeah, it's almost all gone. And maybe that tells us something about when global human civilization will end. Think about that between now and next time we get together. Father in heaven, we do thank you for a God that's given us such an incredibly well-designed planet. Even the rain that falls upon us, the precipitation that's frozen and liquid, Father, we're amazed at how well it's been designed to provide for all of our needs. So, Father, I pray that we would give you appropriate credit, that we would not just take all of this for granted. And thank you, too, Lord, for putting us human beings here on planet Earth at the ideal time. Lord, we're at the best interglacial that's ever existed in the history of the Earth, and you put us here at the appropriate time so that we can launch and sustain this incredible civilization you've enabled us to be able to muster. Father, I pray that we would use the technology you've placed in our hands, the wealth that you've placed in our hands, for the purpose for what you've created. Father, Lord, I pray you'd speak to each of us that knows you as Lord and Savior, that you would give us an even stronger motivation to use our intellect, our knowledge, our wealth, our technology, to take the good news of salvation to Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, here and abroad. Father, we may see you returning quickly rather than slowly, so we can enter into an even greater and more marvelous creation. In Jesus' name, amen.